She's in pretty good shape. He had $40,000 in a personal bank account, $100,000 in his law firm checking account, $300,000 in a mutual fund, and he had a litigation expense fund with $200,000 in it. His other assets are the Cessna, which of course is now worth nothing but insured at $60,000. His house and acreage are appraised by the county at $140,000, and he wants that to be sold. His office building is appraised by the city of Brady at $190,000, and I get that, according to his will. The house has a small mortgage. The office does not. Beyond that, it's all personal assets. His Jeep, his truck, his office furniture, etc. What about the family farm? Annette asked. Nope. Gray Mountain is still owned by our father, and we have not spoken in years. I don't have to remind you that he didn't make it to his son's funeral last week. Besides, the land is not worth much. I suppose I'll inherit it one day, but I'm not counting my money. Samantha said, I really don't think I should be included in this conversation. It's personal and private, and right now I know more than his wife does. Jeff shrugged and said, Come on, Samantha. She grabbed the doorknob and said, You guys talk all the business you want. I've had enough. I'll walk home. Before they could respond, she was gone, outside the room and hustling across the gravel parking lot. The motel was on the edge of town, not far from the jail where Romy had taken her barely 2 months earlier. She needed the cool air and the walk, and she needed to get away from the Gray boys and their troubles. She had great sympathy for Jeff and the loss of his brother. She felt an emptiness herself, but she was also appalled at his recklessness. Tampering with the computers would guarantee more trouble from the FBI. Jeff was cocky enough to think he could outfox the feds and disappear whenever he wanted, but she doubted it. She passed some houses on Main Street and smiled at the scenes inside. Most families were either having dinner or clearing the table. Televisions were on. Kids were at the tables. She passed Donovan's office and felt her throat tighten. He'd been dead for a week, and she missed him greatly. Had he been single, there was no doubt some manner of romantic and physical relationship would have sprung to life not long after she arrived in Brady. Two young, single lawyers in a small town, enjoying each other's company, both flirting and maneuvering, it would have been inevitable. She remembered Annette's warnings about Donovan and his fondness for the ladies, and wondered again if she had been truthful. Or was she simply protecting her own interests? Was she getting Donovan all to herself and didn't want to share? Jeff was convinced he was murdered. Her father was not. How much did it really matter when Samantha considered what was obvious? He was gone forever. She turned around and walked back to the Brady Grill, where she ordered a salad and coffee and tried to kill time. She did not want to return to the office, nor did she want to go sit in her apartment. After 2 months in Brady, she was feeling the boredom. She enjoyed the work and the daily drama around the clinic, but the lack of anything to do at night was getting monotonous. She ate quickly and paid her check to Sarge, the grumpy old man who owned the cafe, wished him a good night and pleasant dreams, and left. It was 7:30, still too early to turn in. So she marched on, taking in the brisk air and stretching her legs. She had walked every street in Brady and knew they were all safe. A dog might growl, and a teenager might whistle, but she was a tough city girl who had endured far worse. On a dark street behind the high school, she heard footsteps behind her. Heavy sounds of someone who was not trying to follow in silence. She turned at a corner, and the footsteps did the same. She picked a street lined with homes, almost all with porch lights on, and turned onto it, the same footsteps followed. At an intersection, and at a place where she could scream and people would hear her, she stopped and turned around. The man kept walking until he was only 5 feet away. "You want something?" she asked, ready to kick and scratch and yell if necessary. "Nope, just out for a stroll. Same as you." White male, age 40, heavy beard, 6'2", bushy hair boiling out from under an unmarked cap, and a thick barn coat with both hands stuffed into large pockets. "Bullshit. You're following me. Say something quick before I start screaming." "You're in way over your head, Ms. Kofor," he said. Slight mountain twang. Definitely a local. But he knew her name. "You know my name. What's yours?" "Pick one. Call me Fred if you like." "Oh, I like Bozo better. Fred sucks. Let's go with Bozo." "Whatever." "I'm so glad you think this is funny." "What's on your mind, Bozo?" Unfazed, unflinching, he said, "You're running with the wrong crowd. And you're playing a game in which you don't know the rules. You need to keep your cute little ass over in the legal clinic, where you can take care of the poor folks and stay out of trouble. Better yet, for you and for everyone else, pack your shit and go back to New York." "Are you threatening me, Bozo?" Damned right he was. The threat was being delivered in a dramatic and unmistakable fashion. "Take it any way you like, Ms. Kofor." "So, I wonder who you work for. Krull Mining? Lone Rock Coal? Strayhorn Coal? East Point Mining? There are just so many thugs to choose from. And let's not forget those crooks in nice suits over at Casper Slate. Who signs your paycheck, Bozo?" "They pay me in cash," he said, as he took a step closer. She threw up both hands and said, "One more step, Bozo, and I'll scream so loud half of Brady will come running." A group of teenagers made a loud approach from behind him, and Bozo lost interest quickly. Almost under his breath, he said, "We'll be watching." "So will I," she retorted, but had no idea what she meant. She exhaled mightily and realized how dry her mouth was. Her heart pounded, and she needed to sit down. Bozo disappeared as the teenagers passed without a word or a glance. Samantha began a rapid zigzag back to her apartment. One block from it, another man materialized from the darkness and stopped her on the sidewalk. "We need to talk," Jeff said. "This must be my night," she said, as they began walking away from her apartment. She replayed the encounter with Bozo and kept her eyes moving for more signs of him. There was nothing, though, from the shadows. Jeff listened and nodded as if he knew Bozo personally. He said, "Here's what's going down. The FBI paid a visit here today, but they also raided the offices of the other three law firms that signed on to sue Krull Mining in the Hammer Valley case. These guys are friends of Donovan's. They were all at his funeral last week. Two firms in Charleston, one in Louisville. Lawyers who specialize in toxic torts and pool their resources and manpower to fight the bad guys. Well, they got raided today, which means, among other things, that the FBI, and we assume Krull Mining too, now know the truth. And the truth is that Donovan did not turn over the stolen documents to the other lawyers. Not yet. That was not the plan. Donovan was very careful with the documents, and he did not want to incriminate the other lawyers, so he simply described what's in the documents. The strategy among the lawyers was to file suit, drag Krull Mining into court, goad the company and its lawyers into telling a bunch of lies under oath, then produce the documents for the judge and jury to enjoy. In the general opinions of the lawyers, The documents are worth at least $500 million in punitive damages. In all likelihood, they will also lead to criminal investigations, indictments, and so on. So the FBI will be back shortly, this time looking for you. I think so, yes. They believe Donovan had the documents. Now they know the other lawyers do not. So where are they? Where are they? Close by. And you have them? Yes. They walked a block in silence. Jeff called out to an old man sitting under a blanket on a porch. A few steps later, she asked, "How did he get the documents?" "Do you really want to know?" "I'm not sure. But knowledge is not a crime, is it?" "You're the lawyer." They turned a corner onto a darker street. Jeff coughed, cleared his throat, and began. At first, Donovan hired a hacker, this Israeli guy who travels the world selling his talents for nice sums of money. Kroll had digitized some of its internal stuff, and the hacker got inside without too much of a hassle. He found some pretty interesting material about the Peck Mountain mine site and Slurry Pond, enough to get Donovan excited. It was obvious, though, that Kroll had kept a lot of records out of its digital storage system. The hacker went as far as he could, then bailed out, covered his tracks, and disappeared. $15,000 for a week's work. Not bad, I guess. Risky, though, because he got caught on another job 3 months ago and is now sitting in a jail in Vancouver. Anyway, Donovan made the decision to scope out Kroll's headquarters near Harlan, Kentucky. It's a small town, and it's kind of strange having such a big operation based in such a rural area. But that's not unusual in the coal fields. Donovan visited a few times, always changing disguises. He loved the cloak and dagger stuff and thought he was a real genius at espionage. And he was very good. He picked a holiday weekend, Memorial Day of last year, and went in on Friday afternoon dressed like a phone repairman. He rented a white, unmarked cargo van and parked it with some other cars in the lot. He even put fake license plates on the van. Once inside, he vanished into an attic and waited until closing time. There were armed security guards and surveillance cameras outside, but not much inside. I was watching from nearby. So was Vic. Both of us armed and ready with an emergency plan in case something went wrong. For 3 days, Donovan was on the inside and we were on the outside, hiding in the woods, watching, waiting, fighting off ticks and mosquitoes. It was miserable. We were using high-frequency radios to keep in touch and to keep each other awake. Donovan found the kitchen, ate all the food, and slept on a sofa in the lobby. Vic and I were sleeping in our trucks. Donovan also found the records, a treasure trove of incriminating documents that detailed Kroll's cover-up of the Peck Mountain site and all its problems. He copied thousands of documents and put the originals back in the files as if nothing happened. On that Monday, Memorial Day, a cleaning crew showed up, and they almost caught him. I saw them first, called Donovan, and he barely made it back into the attic before the janitors entered the building. He stayed there for 3 hours, smothering in the heat. How did he get the documents out? Trash bags. Just another load of garbage. He put 7 bags in a dumpster behind the office building. We knew the garbage truck would run Tuesday morning. Vic and I followed it to the landfill. Donovan walked out of the office, changed costumes, and became an FBI agent, and showed up at the landfill with a badge. The people who work at landfills really don't care where the stuff comes from or what happens to it. And after a few harsh words from Agent Donovan, they threw up their hands. We loaded the trash bags into the rental van and sprinted back to Brady. We worked around the clock for 3 days, sorting, arranging, and indexing. Then we hid the documents in a mini storage not far from Vic's home near Beckley. Later, we moved them again. And again. And the good folks at Kroll Mining had no clue that someone had vandalized their offices? It wasn't that clean. Donovan had to jimmy some locks and break into some file cabinets. And he kept some of the original documents. He left a trail. There were surveillance cameras all over the exterior, and we're sure they recorded images of him. But you would never know it was him because of the disguises. Plus, Donovan and Vic thought it was important for Kroll to know that someone had been there. We went back later that afternoon, that Tuesday, and watched from a distance. Police cars were coming and going. Folks were obviously agitated. It's a great story, but it strikes me as being incredibly reckless. Of course it was, but that was my brother. His philosophy was that since the bad guys are always cheating. I know. He told me more than once. What's on his computer hard drives? Nothing sensitive. He wasn't stupid. Then why did you take them? He told me to. I had strict instructions in the event something happened to him. There was a case in Mississippi a few years back where the FBI raided a law office and grabbed all the computers. Donovan lived in fear of that, so I had my orders. And what are you supposed to do with the Kroll documents? Deliver them to the other lawyers before the FBI finds them. Can the FBI find them? Highly unlikely. They were approaching the courthouse from a narrow side street. Jeff pulled something out of his pocket and handed it to her. It's a prepaid cell phone, he said. Your very own. She stared at it and said, I have a phone, thanks. But your phone is not secure. This one is. She looked at him and did not reach for the phone. And why might I need this? To talk to me and Vic. No one else. She took a step back and shook her head. I don't believe this, Jeff. If I take that phone, then I join your little conspiracy. Why me? Because we trust you. You don't even know me. I've only been here for 2 months. Exactly. You don't know anyone or anything. You've yet to be corrupted. You don't talk because you have no one to talk to. You're smart as hell, fun to be around, and very cute. Oh, great. Just what I need to hear. I'll look spectacular in an orange jumpsuit with chains around my ankles. You would, yes. You'd look great in anything. Or nothing. Was that a pickup line? Maybe. Okay, the answer is not now. Jeff, I'm seriously considering packing my bags, hopping in my rented car, slinging gravel out of here, as you locals like to say, and not stopping until I get to New York City, where I belong. I don't like what's happening around me, and I did not ask for all this trouble. You can't leave. You know too much. After 24 hours in Manhattan, I'll forget it all. Believe me. Down the street, Sarge slammed the door to the cafe and lumbered away. Nothing else moved on Main Street. Jeff gently took her arm and led her off the sidewalk to a dark spot beneath some trees near a memorial to Nolan County's war dead. He pointed to something in the distance, far behind the courthouse, 2 blocks away. Almost whispering, he said, See that black Ford pickup truck parked next to the old Volkswagen? I don't know a Ford from a Dodge. Who is it? There are 2 of them. Probably your new pal Bozo and a jackass I refer to as Jimmy. Jimmy? Jimmy Carter. Big teeth, big smile, sandy hair. Got it. How clever. What are Bozo and Jimmy doing sitting in a parked truck at 8:30 tonight? Talking about us. I want to go to New York, where it's safe. Can't really blame you. Look, I'm disappearing for a couple of days. Please take this phone so I'll have someone to talk to. He slid the prepaid cell phone into her hand, and after a second or two, she took it. Chapter 27. Early Tuesday morning, Samantha left Brady and headed for Madison, West Virginia, an hour and a half drive that could take twice that long if the roads were choked with coal trucks and school buses. A strong breeze scattered the few leaves still on the trees. The color was gone, and the ridges and valleys were a dull, depressing shade of brown that wouldn't change until spring. There was a chance of light snow tomorrow, the first of the season. She caught herself glancing into the rearview mirror, and at times managed to smile at her paranoia. Why would anyone waste time following her through the mountains of Appalachia? She was just a temp, an unpaid intern who was growing more homesick by the day. She planned to spend Christmas in New York, to catch up with friends and places, and she was already wondering if she would have the guts to return to Appalachia. Her new cell phone was on the passenger seat, and she glanced at it and wondered what Jeff was doing. For an hour, she thought about calling him just to see if it worked, but she knew it did. And when exactly was she supposed to use the damn thing, and for what purpose? On the main highway south of town, she found the meeting place, the Cedar Grove Missionary Baptist Church. She had explained to her clients that they needed to talk, in private, and not at the gas station where Buddy drank his morning coffee, and everyone felt free to participate in every conversation. The risers suggested their church, and Samantha speculated it was because they did not want her to see their home. They were sitting in Buddy's truck in the parking lot, watching the occasional car go by, seemingly without a care in the world. Mavis hugged Samantha as if she were family, and they walked to the fellowship hall behind the small chapel. The door was unlocked. The large room was empty. They pulled folding chairs around a card table and talked about the weather and Christmas plans. Finally, Samantha got around to business. I assume you received the letter from Donovan's office with the tragic news. Both nodded sadly. Buddy mumbled, "Such a good man." Mavis asked, "What does it mean? You know, for us and the case." "That's why I'm here, to explain and answer questions. The black lung claim will continue at full speed. It was filed last month and, as you know, we're waiting for the medical exam. But I'm afraid the big lawsuit is dead. For now, anyway. When Donovan filed the case over in Lexington, he was acting alone. Usually in these big cases, especially ones that take years and eat up a lot of cash, Donovan would put together a litigation team of several other lawyers and firms. They would split the labor and expenses, but in your case, he was still trying to convince some of his lawyer buddies to hop on board. Frankly, they were reluctant. Taking on Lone Rock Coal and its law firm and trying to prove behavior that's criminal is a huge job. Y'all explained all this before, Buddy said bluntly. Donovan explained it. I was in the room, but as I made clear, I was not joining the big case as a lawyer. So we have no one? Mavis asked. That's correct. As of now, there's no one to handle the case, and it has to be dismissed. I'm sorry. Buddy's breathing was labored enough when he was perfectly content. But the slightest bit of stress or unpleasantness made him gasp. This ain't right, he said, his mouth wide open as he sucked in air. Mavis stared at her in disbelief, then wiped a tear from her cheek. No, it's not right, Samantha said. But what happened to Donovan was not right either. He was only 39 years old and was doing great work as a lawyer. His death was a senseless tragedy that has left all of his clients out in the cold. You're not the only ones who are looking for answers. Y'all suspect foul play? Buddy asked. It's still under investigation, and so far there's no evidence of wrongdoing. A lot of unanswered questions, but no real proof. Looks kinda fishy to me, he said. We catch them some of bitches red-handed hiding documents and screwing people. Then Donovan files a billion-dollar lawsuit, and then his airplane crashes under mysterious circumstances. Buddy, your language, Mavis scolded. You are in church. I'm in the fellowship hall. The church is right over there. It's still the church. Watch your language. Chastised, Buddy shrugged and said, I'll bet they found something. Mavis said, They're harassing him at work. It started right after we filed the big lawsuit over in Lexington. Tell her about it, Buddy. Don't you think it's important, Samantha? Don't you need to know? It ain't nothing I can't handle, Buddy said. Just a little nuisance treatment. They put me back driving a haul truck, which is a little rougher than a track loader. But it ain't no big deal. And they put me to work at night 3 times last week. My schedule was set for months, and now they're jacking me all around with different shifts. I can take it. I still got a job and a good wage. Hell, the way it is now with no union protection, they could walk in tomorrow and fire me on the spot. I couldn't do nothing about it. They busted our union 20 years ago, and we've been fair game ever since. I'm lucky to have a job. Mavis said, True, but you can't work much longer. He has to climb up these steps to get in the haul truck, and he can barely make it. They watch him, too, just waiting for him to collapse or something so they can say he's disabled and therefore a danger, and then they can fire him. They can fire me anyway. I just said that. Mavis bit her tongue as Buddy inhaled noisily. Samantha removed some papers from her briefcase and placed them on the table. She said, This is a motion to dismiss, and I need you to sign it. Dismiss what? Buddy asked, though he knew the answer. He refused to look at the papers. The federal lawsuit against Lone Rock Coal and Casper Slate. Who files it? You met Maddie, my boss at the clinic. She's Donovan's aunt, and she's also the attorney for his estate. The court will give her the authority to wind up his business. And what if I don't sign it? Samantha had not anticipated this, and knowing so little about federal procedure, she wasn't sure of her answer. But a quick response was needed nonetheless. If the case is not pushed by you, the plaintiff, then it will eventually be dismissed by the court. So, either way, it's dead? Buddy asked. Yes. Okay. I'm not quitting. I'll not sign it. Mavis blurted. Why don't you take the case? You're a lawyer. Both eyed her intently, and it was obvious the question had been kicked around at length. This Samantha had anticipated. She replied, Yes, but I am not experienced in federal court, and I'm not licensed in Kentucky. They absorbed this without comment, and without really understanding it. A lawyer is a lawyer, right? Mavis shifted gears with, Now, on this black lung claim, you said you were going to calculate all the back benefits we're entitled to, and you said if we win the case, we get to go back to the day we first filed the claim some 9 years ago. Is that right? That's correct, Samantha said, shuffling for some notes. And according to our numbers, it's about $85,000. That's not much money, Buddy said in disgust, as if the paltry sum could be blamed on Samantha. He drew in mightily and continued. They ought to pay more. A hell of a lot more after what they done. I should have quit working in the mines 10 years ago when I got sick. And I would have if I'd had the benefits. But no, hell no, I had to keep working and keep breathing the dust. Just got sicker and sicker, Mavis added gravely. Now I won't be able to work another year, 2 at max. And if we ever get him in court, they'll be liable for almost nothing. It ain't right.
I agree, Samantha said. But we've had this conversation, buddy, and more than once.
That's why I want to sue them bastards in federal court.
Your language, buddy.
I'll cuss if I want to, damn it, Mavis.
Look, I need to be going, Samantha said, reaching for her briefcase. I wish you would reconsider your decision not to sign this dismissal.
I'm not quitting, Buddy said, gasping.
Fine, but I'm not driving over here again for this. Understood? He just nodded. Mavis walked out with her, leaving Buddy behind for a few moments. At the car, Mavis said,
Thank you so much, Samantha. We are grateful. We went years without a lawyer, and now it's comforting to know we have one. He's dying, and he knows it. So he has some bad days when he's not too pleasant.
I understand. At the ancient Conoco station, Samantha stopped for gas and, hopefully, a drinkable cup of coffee. A few vehicles were parked to the side of the building, all with West Virginia license plates, and none of which she recognized. Jeff had told her to be more aware, to watch every car and truck, notice every license plate, look at faces without staring, and listen to voices while appearing uninterested. Assume someone is always watching, he had warned. But she found it difficult to accept. They believe we have something they desperately want, he had said. The we part still troubled her. She didn't recall joining anyone's team. As she stared at the pump, she saw a man enter the store, though she had not noticed another vehicle arrive in the past few minutes. Bozo was back. She paid with a credit card at the pump and could have sped away, but she needed confirmation. She entered through the front door and said good morning to the clerk at the register. Several old men were sitting in rockers around a pot-bellied stove, and none seemed to notice her. A few more steps and she was in the tiny cafe, which was nothing but a cheap add-on with a dozen tables adorned with checkered cloth. 5 people were eating, sipping coffee, and talking. He was seated at the counter, staring at the grill, where a cook was frying bacon. She couldn't see his face and didn't want a scene. And for a second, she stood awkwardly in the middle of the cafe, uncertain. She caught a glance or two and decided to leave. She drove back into Madison and stopped at a convenience store where she bought a road map. Her leased Ford had a GPS, but she had not bothered to program it. She needed directions, fast. Half an hour later, as she drifted along a county road somewhere in Lawrence County, Kentucky, her new cell phone finally found enough service for a call. Jeff answered after 4 rings. She calmly explained what was happening, and he made her repeat everything in slow motion.
He wanted you to see him, Jeff said.
Why else would he risk being seen? It's not an unusual tactic. He knows you're not going to punch him or anything. So he just delivers a not-so-subtle message. Which is, we're watching. We can always find you. You're hanging around with the wrong people and you might get hurt.
Okay, I got the message. Now what?
Nothing. Just keep your eyes open and see if he's waiting when you get back to Brady.
I don't want to go back to Brady. Sorry. Where are you?
I'm on the road for a few days.
Vague enough.
She drove into Brady just before noon and saw no one suspicious. She parked on the street near the office and from behind her sunglasses, managed to scan the area before going inside. On the one hand, she felt like an idiot. On the other, she half expected to see Bozo lurking behind a tree.
And what the hell was he going to do?
Stalking her would bore any private eye to death. The Crump Brood was calling. Evidently, Francine had told one of them that she had changed her mind again and planned to meet with Ms. Kofor and make no changes to her existing will. This, of course, fired up the Crumps, and they were burning up the phone lines in an effort to find Ms. Kofor and set her straight, again. No one at the clinic had heard from Francine. Samantha reluctantly took the stack of phone messages from Barb, who offered the unsolicited suggestion that she should call only one, perhaps Jonah, the oldest, and explain that their dear mother had not called the clinic and insist that they stop harassing the front desk. She closed her door and called Jonah. He said hello pleasantly enough, then immediately threatened to sue her and get her disbarred if she again messed with Mama's wheel. She said she hadn't seen nor heard from Francine in the past 24 hours. She had no appointment scheduled with her. Nothing. This calmed him a little, though he was ready to erupt any second. She said, "Could it be possible that your mother is playing games with you?"
"Mama don't think like that," he said.
She politely asked him to call off the dogs, to ask his siblings to stop calling the clinic. He refused, and they finally brokered a deal. If Francine came to the office seeking legal advice, Samantha would ask her to call Jonah and inform him of what she was doing. She quickly hung up, and 2 seconds later, Barb buzzed her.
"It's the FBI," she said.
The caller identified himself as Agent Banahan from the Roanoke office and said he was looking for a man named Jeff Gray. Samantha admitted to knowing Jeff Gray and asked the agent how she might go about confirming his identity. Banahan said he would be happy to stop by her office in half an hour or so. He was in the area. She said she would not discuss anything over the phone and agreed to the meeting. 20 minutes later, he was in the reception area being examined by Barb, who thought he was quite cute and thought of herself as quite the flirt. Banahan was not impressed and took a seat in the small conference room where Samantha and Maddie were waiting with a recorder on the table. After terse introductions and a close examination of his credentials by both lawyers, Maddie began by saying, "Jeff Gray is my nephew."
"We know that,"
Banahan said with a smirk, and the women instantly disliked him.
"Do you know where he is?"
Maddie looked at Samantha and said,
"I don't. Do you?"
"No." She wasn't lying. At that moment, she had no idea where Jeff was hiding.
"When did you last speak to him?" he asked, in Samantha's direction.
Maddie interrupted by saying,
"Look, his brother was killed Monday of last week. We buried him on Wednesday, 5 days before you boys raided his office. Under the terms of his will, Jeff is the executor and I'm the attorney for the executor. So yes, I'll be talking a lot to my nephew. What is it you want?"
"We have a lot of questions."
"Do you have a warrant for his arrest?"
"No."
"Good. So he is not evading an arrest?"
"That's right. We just want to talk."
Any and all conversations with Jeff Gray will take place right here at this table. Understood? I will advise him to say nothing outside the presence of Ms. Kofor and me. Okay?"
"That's fine, Miss Wyatt. So, when can we chat with him?"
Maddie relaxed and said, "Well, I'm not sure where he is today,
I just tried his cell and it went straight to voicemail.
Samantha shook her head as if she hadn't spoken to Jeff in weeks. Maddie continued.
We were scheduled to go to court tomorrow to open the estate and start the process of probate, but the judge rescheduled it until next week. So, I don't know where he is at this moment.
Samantha asked, Is this related to the actions the FBI took yesterday when it confiscated files from the office of Donovan Gray?
Banahan showed her both palms and said, Isn't that pretty obvious?
Seems like it is.
Who are you investigating now that Donovan Gray is dead?
I'm not at liberty to say.
Maddie asked, Is Jeff a subject of your investigation?
No, not at this time.
He's done nothing wrong, Maddie said.
Chapter 28. The damage was inflicted at the Millard Break Mine near Wittsburg, Kentucky, in an attack similar to the others. Firing from a position on the east face of Trace Mountain, a densely wooded ridge 500 feet above the strip mine, the snipers found their range from about 700 yards and had a grand time taking out 47 tires, each weighing 900 pounds and costing $18,000. The two night watchmen, both heavily armed themselves, told authorities the attack lasted about 10 minutes and at times sounded like a war as sniper rifles snapped and echoed across the valley and tires exploded nearby. The first volley hit at 3:05 a.m. All mining machinery was idle, all operators safely at home. One security guard jumped into a truck for some idea of pursuit. He wasn't sure exactly where he might be headed, but was soon dissuaded when the pickup took fire and had two of its tires blown off. The other security guard ducked into an office trailer to call the law, but was forced to take cover when a burst of gunfire blew out all the windows. These were significant events because they directly endangered human life. In the other attacks, the snipers had been careful not to hurt anyone. They went after machinery, not people. Now, though, they were breaking serious laws. The guards thought there were at least three rifles in play, though, admittedly, it was difficult to tell in the chaos. The owner, Crow Mining, made the usual harsh and threatening statements to the press. It offered an impressive reward. The county sheriff promised a thorough investigation and swift arrests. Some rather blustery and short-sighted comments in light of the fact that these eco-terrorists had been marauding through southern Appalachia with impunity for the better part of 2 years now. The news story went on to recap recent attacks and speculated that the snipers had used the same weaponry as before. The 51mm cartridge that's normally fired from the M24E long-range rifle, the same one Army snipers were using in Iraq, and routinely scoring kills at over 1,000 yards. An expert was quoted as saying that using such a rifle from such a distance, and in the dead of night, with easily available optic technology, would make it virtually impossible to track down the snipers. Krull Mining said there was a tight market for tires, a shortage in some places, and the mine could be closed for several days. Samantha read the story on her laptop as she sipped coffee Friday morning at the office. She had a sick feeling that Jeff was involved with the gang, if not its leader. Almost 2 weeks after the death of his brother, he needed to make a statement, to lash out in his own brand of retribution and strike a blow at Krull Mining. If her hunch was accurate, it was just another reason to pack her bags. She emailed the story to Maddie down the hall, then walked into her office and said, To be perfectly honest, I think Jeff is involved in this. Maddie responded with a fake laugh at such foolishness. She said, Samantha, this is the first Friday in December, the day we decorate the office, along with everybody else in Brady. It's the first day I've managed to feel good and actually smile since Donovan died.
I don't want to ruin the day by worrying about what Jeff is up to. Have you talked to him? No, why should I? We're not involved, as you like to say. He doesn't check in with me. Good. Let's forget about Jeff for a little while and try to muster up some Christmas cheer. Barb cranked up the radio, and soon carols were ringing throughout the offices. She was in charge of the tree, a sad little plastic reproduction they kept in a broom closet the rest of the year. But by the time they strung up lights and hung ornaments, it was showing signs of life. Annette placed ivy and mistletoe all over the front porch and tacked a wreath to the door. They hauled in food, and lunch was a leisurely affair in the conference room, with Chester supplying a beef stew from a crock pot. All work was forgotten, all clients ignored. The phone seldom rang, as if the rest of the county was also busy getting in the spirit. After lunch, Samantha went to the courthouse, and along the way, noticed that every shop and office was being decorated. A city crew was busy hanging silver bells on light posts above the streets. Another was anchoring a large, freshly cut fir in the park next to the courthouse. Christmas was suddenly in the air, and the entire town was catching the spirit. At dark, all of Brady arrived, and throngs of people clogged the sidewalks along Main Street, drifting from store to store, picking up hot cider and gingerbread cookies as they went. Traffic was blocked from the street, and children waited excitedly for the parade. It materialized around 7, when sirens could be heard in the distance. The crowd pressed closer and lined Main. Samantha watched with Kim, Adam, and Annette. The sheriff led the procession, his brown and white patrol car gleaming with fresh polish. His entire fleet followed. Samantha wondered if old Romy might sneak into the action, but there was no sign of him. The high school band marched by with a rather weak rendition of "O Come, All Ye Faithful." It was a small band from a small high school.
"They're not very good, are they?"
Adam whispered to Samantha. "I think they're great," she replied. The Girl Scouts marched by, followed by the Boy Scouts. A float carried some disabled vets in wheelchairs, all happy to be alive and enjoying another Christmas. The star was Mr. Arnold Potter, age 91, a survivor of D-Day 64 years ago. He was the county's greatest living hero. The Shriners zipped about on their mini motorcycles, stealing the show as always. The Rotary Club's float was a nativity scene with real sheep and goats, all behaving for the moment. A large float pulled by a late-model Ford pickup was packed with the children's choir from the First Baptist Church. The kids were dressed in white robes, and their angelic voices sang "O Little Town of Bethlehem" in near-perfect pitch. The mayor rode in a 1958 convertible Thunderbird. He waved and smiled a lot, but no one seemed to care. There were some more police cars, a fire truck from a volunteer brigade, and another float with a bluegrass band picking and strumming a rowdy interpretation of Jingle Bells. A riding club trotted by on a herd of quarter horses, all garbed up in rodeo splendor, humans and animals. Roy Rogers and Trigger would have been proud. The local gas jobber had a shiny new truck with a 10,000-gallon tank, and someone thought it would be a nice addition to the parade. For fun, the driver, a black guy, was blasting non-holiday rap with the windows down. Finally, the reason for the season appeared in his sleigh. Old Saint Nick waved to the boys and girls and tossed candy at their feet. Through a loudspeaker, he chanted, "Ho, ho, ho!" But nothing else. When the parade was out of sight, most of the spectators moved toward the courthouse and gathered in the park beside it. The mayor welcomed everyone and prattled on too long. Another children's choir sang "O Holy Night." Miss Nolan County, a beautiful redhead, was singing "Sweet Little Jesus Boy" when Samantha felt someone touch her right elbow. It was Jeff, with a cap and eyeglasses she had never seen before. She backed away from Kim and Adam, eased through the crowd, and away from it to a dark place near the war memorial. They had stood there last Monday night, looking at Bozo and Jimmy in the distance.
"Are you free tomorrow?"
he asked, almost in a whisper. "It's Saturday. Of course I have nothing to do."
"Let's go hiking."
She hesitated and watched as the mayor flipped a switch and the official Christmas tree lit up.
"Where?"
He slipped a piece of folded paper into her hand and said,
"Directions. See you in the morning."
He pecked her on the cheek and disappeared. She drove to the town of Knox in Curry County and parked in the library lot, a block off Main Street. If she had been followed, she was not aware of it. She walked nonchalantly to Main, west for 3 blocks, and into the Knox Market, a cafe and coffee shop. She asked about a restroom and was pointed toward the rear. She found a door that led to an alley that led to 5th Street. As directed, she walked 2 blocks away from downtown and saw the river. As she approached Larry's trout dock under the bridge, Jeff appeared from the bait shop and pointed to a 20-foot John boat. Without a word, both got in the boat. Samantha in the front bundled against the cold, and Jeff in the back where he started the outboard. He guided the boat away from the dock and eased down on the throttle. They were in the center of the Curry River, and the town was quickly disappearing. They passed under another bridge, and civilization seemed to end. For miles, or however one measures distance on a crooked river, Samantha had no idea, they glided over the dark, still water. The Curry was a narrow, deep river with no rocks or rapids. It wiggled through the mountains, hidden from the sun by soaring cliffs that almost touched one another above the water. They passed a boat, a lone fisherman, staring forlornly at his line, oblivious to them. They passed a small settlement near a sandbar, a collection of floating shacks and boats. River rats, Jeff would later call them. They went deeper and deeper into the canyon, and around each bend, the Curry grew narrower and darker. The loud hum of the outboard prevented conversation, not that either had much to say. It was obvious he was taking her to a place she had never been, but she was not afraid, not hesitant in the least. In spite of his complications, his anger, his current emotional instability, and his recklessness, she trusted him. Or at least, she trusted him enough to go hiking, or whatever he had in mind for the day. Jeff eased off the throttle, and the boat drifted toward the right. An old sign said, "Curry Cutoff," and a concrete ramp came into view. Jeff swung the boat around, and it skidded onto a sandbar. "Hop out here," he said, and she stepped out of the boat. He chained it to a metal rack near the ramp and stopped for a moment to stretch his legs. They had been in the boat for almost an hour. "Well, good morning to you, sir," she said. He smiled and said, "And to you. Thanks for coming." "As if I had a choice. Where exactly are we?" "We're lost in Curry County. Follow me." "Whatever you say." They left the sandbar, stepped into thick woods, and began climbing an unmarked trail that only someone like Jeff could follow. Or Donovan. As it grew steeper, he seemed to pick up the pace. Just as her thighs and calves were beginning to scream, he stopped suddenly in a small clearing and grabbed some cedar branches. He shoved them out of the way, and, of course, there was a Honda four-wheeler just waiting for a ride. "Boys and their toys," she said. "Ever been on one?" he asked.
"I live in Manhattan."
"Hop on." She did. There was a sliver of a seat behind him, She locked her arms around his waist as he cranked the engine and let it roar. "Hold on," he said, and they were off, tearing along the same trail that, seconds earlier, had been barely wide enough for humans. It led to a gravel road, which Jeff attacked like a stunt driver. "Hold on," he yelled again, as he popped a wheelie, and they were practically airborne. Samantha wanted to ask if he could slow down, but instead just squeezed harder and closed her eyes. The ride was thrilling and terrifying, but she knew he would not endanger her. From the gravel road, they turned onto another dirt trail, one that rose at a steep angle. The trees were too thick for stunt work, so Jeff became more cautious. Still, the ride was harrowing and dangerous. After half an hour on the four-wheeler, Samantha was having fond memories of the John boat. "May I ask where we're going?" she said into his ear. "Hiking, right?" The trail peaked, and they raced along a ridge. He turned onto another trail, and they began a descent, a treacherous journey that involved sliding from one side to the other and dodging trees and boulders. They slowed for a second in a clearing and took in a view to their right. "Gray Mountain," he said, nodding at the shaved and barren hill in the distance. "We'll be on our land in just a moment." She hung on for the last leg, and when they splashed across Yellow Creek, she saw the cabin. It was tucked into the side of a hill, a rustic square made of old timbers, with a front porch and a chimney on one end. Jeff parked beside it and said, "Welcome to our little hiding place. I'm sure there's an easier way to get here." "Oh, sure. There's a county road not far away. I'll show you later." "Cool cabin, huh?" "I guess I'm not much on cabins. Donovan showed it to me one day, but we were 1,000 feet in the air. If I remember correctly, he said there's no plumbing, heating, or electricity." "You got it. If we stay tonight, we'll sleep by the fire." Such a sleepover had not been discussed, but by then Samantha was not surprised. She followed him up the steps, across the porch, and into the main room of the cabin. A log was smoldering in the fireplace. "How long have you been here?" she asked. "Got here late last night, slept by the fire. It's really nice and cozy. You want a beer?" She glanced at her watch. 11:45. "It's a little early." There was a cooler next to a small dining table. "Do you have water?" He handed her a bottle of water and opened a beer. They sat in two wooden chairs near the fireplace. He took a swig and said, "They were here this week. Someone, not sure who. But I doubt it was the FBI, because they would need to produce a search warrant. It was probably operatives working for Kroll or some other outfit." "How do you know they were here?" "Got them on video. 2 months ago, Donovan and I rigged up 2 surveillance cameras. One is in a tree across the creek. The other is in a tree about 50 feet from the front porch. They're activated here at the front door. If someone opens the door, the cameras come on and run for 30 minutes. The trespassers have no clue. Last Wednesday at 3:21 to be exact, 4 goons showed up here and went through the cabin. I'm sure they were looking for the documents, hard drives, laptops, or anything else that might be of use. Interesting, though, that they did not leave a trace. Nothing. Not even the dust was disturbed, so you gotta figure these guys are pretty good. They also think I'm stupid, but now I know what they look like. I have the 4 faces, and when I see them, I'll be ready." "Are they watching now?" "I doubt it. My truck is hidden in a place they'll never see. This is our land, Samantha, and we know it better than anyone. You want to take a look? Let's go." He grabbed a backpack and she followed him out of the cabin. They trekked along Yellow Creek for half a mile and stopped in a clearing to enjoy some rare sunshine. Jeff said, "I don't know how much Donovan told you, but this is the only part of our property that was not destroyed by the strip miners. We have about 20 acres here that was untouched. Beyond that ridge is Gray Mountain and the rest of our land. And it was all ruined." They hiked on, climbing the ridge until the woods opened up and they stopped to take in the devastation. It was desolate enough from 1,000 feet in the air, but from ground level, it was truly depressing. The mountain itself had been reduced to an ugly, pockmarked hump of rock and weeds. With great effort, they climbed to the top of it and gazed through the choked-off valleys below. For lunch, they ate sandwiches in the shade of a dilapidated trailer once used as mining headquarters. Jeff told stories about watching the destruction as a kid. He'd been 9 years old when the mining began. Samantha was curious as to why he had chosen Gray Mountain as their Saturday hiking destination. Like Donovan, he preferred not to talk about what happened there. The hiking was far from pleasant. The landscapes and views were ruined, for the most part. They were smack in the middle of the Appalachian Mountains, with thousands of miles of unspoiled trails at their disposal. The situation with Kroll Mining was extremely dangerous. They could have been followed. So why Gray Mountain? But she did not ask. She might later, but not right then. As they were descending, they walked past a vine-covered waste yard of rusting machinery, obviously abandoned when Vaden Cole fled the site. Lying on its side, and partially covered with weeds, was a massive tire. Samantha walked closer and said, "What is this used for?" "The haul trucks. That's a small one, actually. Only about 10 feet in diameter. Nowadays, they're almost twice as big." "I was reading the news yesterday. Did you see the story about the Millard Break shootout the other night? These eco terrorists?" "Sure. Everybody knows about them." She turned and stared at him with unblinking eyes. He took a step back and said, "What?" She kept staring and said, "Oh, nothing. It just seems to me that eco-terrorism would appeal to you and Donovan, and perhaps Vic Canzaro as well." "I love those guys, whoever they are, but I really don't want to go to prison." He was walking away as he said this. At the foot of Gray Mountain, they walked along the edge of a creek bed. There was no water. There had been none in a long time.